Is this a good outcome, great outcome, not great outcome for the journey? I would say it's an overall sort of good outcome. When I ask all of these pioneers, the one mistake that they make, that they would all say that we started treating it as a tech business and not as a financial services business.
Our data shows that from a consumer standpoint, you know, whenever we put BNPL options on payment page, 1/3 consumers go and click. So consumers want it. You know, why is there not a emergence of a standalone company in India?
When we raised from Colgate and Tech Kit, there was one sense which is there's a lot of strategic value to get, but another which is it's limiting in terms of exit opportunity. They're viewed differently, but sometimes that is also a good thing because your mortality risk becomes a lot lesser.
From a founder perspective, you are creating these companies as your legacy. How do you think about this exit, selling out? What's the right way for founders to think about it? Essentially, the 42% is spending that 144%, right? It's essentially that the people who remain are actually spending 3x. It's the biggest indicator of the kind of consumer value that business is adding.
We are hearing that even Cash Free as well as Razorpay, like they've given notices to their merchants that they're not going to support or they're going to move away from that orchestration layer.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 11 of the Asymmetric Podcast. We have a super exciting episode lined up for you. With me are my regular partners in crime, Revant Bhatte and Chirag Taneja, but also have a very special guest, Vikram Vaidyanathan, senior partner, managing director at Z47 erstwhile Matrix Partners. He leads their investments in fintech and consumer, and you know, all three of us have known Vikram for many, many years. He's an investor in Chirag and Revant's company, so would love to dig his brain on all the topics we have for you. Of course, top of mind is Amazon's acquisition of Axio, a big strategic acquisition in the fintech space. Again, we will kind of dive deeper into acquisitions, what it means, strategic investors. The second topic we have, of course, is Zomato's results. It's a pet topic for the three of us and top of mind for the ecosystem. So we will do a full-blown episode with Swiggy later on. And of course, the entire ecosystem development with JustPay, RazorPay, CashFree, and what's happening there. Chirag is in the middle of that, so we'll of course talk to Vikram about it. But today's episode is all about Vikram's points of view and the three of us stress testing all his hypotheses and points of view. So welcome, and we hope that you have fun on episode 11. Vikram, welcome.
In the past week, which is the Amazon Axio deal, would be great to sort of maybe break that down as to, because I think that it's a 10-year-old company, which was broadly in the consumer lending space, had an interesting journey, I think pre-COVID or at least pre-2020 was doing a lot more distributed lending across many touch points. And then subsequently, I think post-2020 largely was lending to Amazon customers, being part of the buy now pay later program that Amazon had. Would be great to maybe spend 10 minutes on, you know, the 10-year journey that company had, as well as what are the potential learnings for both entrepreneurs as well as VCs from this journey. Any thoughts, Chirag, Vikram, on this?
Should I put up sort of the news on screen so that, you know, I'm assuming you guys can see this, and I'm just sort of, this is the company Axio. It was called Capital Float before when it started that journey. And this is all the news that we have, which is Amazon's acquiring it in an all-cash $200 million type deal. It is still to be ratified and approved by the RBI. And what Revant just said, right? It ended up in a bunch of different loan businesses, but all through partnerships, and one of their most successful partnerships is Amazon. Amazon is also an investor, and then a lot of our friends in the ecosystem, Lightrock, Peak, Ribbit, I think Elevation in the early days, I think all of them are investors in the company. Both Sashank and Gaurav, who were the founders of the company, essentially pioneered this, you know, fintech NBFC, and were part of DLAI for a long time. So I think that's the context right now. I think there are several things, at least for me, which are very interesting to sort of unpack. there. One, you know, question you ask is this a good outcome, great outcome, not great outcome for the journey? I would say it's an overall sort of good outcome. It's not like a great outcome that somebody, you know, either the investors or founders would be celebrating. But all things considered, you know, getting to sort of a good cash outcome actually is something that we should be celebrating as an overall ecosystem. Now, in terms of just context on, you know, how do you think about at this stage, you know, what are the choices with founders, especially in, you know, fintechs and NBFCs in this context, right? And, you know, I don't have full, you know, confirmation, but as far as I know, that there was actually, they had options for future round financing as well at the same time. So I'm assuming my intelligence is mostly right. And therefore, you know, they had an option of raising money. And then they had an option of somebody who's a significant partner actually making an offer to sell. And how do you think about it at that stage, right? The one thing with respect to NBFC is money is raw material. That's essentially something that you'll keep needing and you'll keep raising. Now, in the NBFC space in particular, there is a, you know, everybody says there is this mythical ceiling that as you get to 5,000 crores, you have to change the way you, 5,000 crores, you have to change your balance sheet mix. You can't keep borrowing from banks, you have to start doing deposits. You have to actually have multiple channels in which you raise debt. Then, you know, at some point in time, you have to go public because you can't be dependent on private markets to be giving you equity. Right? Because you need both equity and debt in some proportion, right? And you have to keep growing that the kind of base. Then there is a ceiling. Before it used to be 10,000 crores, now people say 20,000 crores, where if you don't have a conglomerate, if you like take the largest NBFCs in India, there's Bajaj involved, there's Tata involved, there's Aditya Birla involved. Essentially, you have a conglomerate which is very well rated, and therefore banks can actually take a lot of risk on the conglomerate. And without that conglomerate, of course, you can't actually grow your balance sheet. That's the next ceiling that keeps coming.
Could also be a distribution advantage, no, Vikram? Like you would have either consumer businesses, like for example, Tata, Birla, or a Bajaj, all of them sort of have the ability to maybe latch on to some of their other businesses and maybe build a lending book from there as well. Is that a consideration?
I think there's a consideration that yes, in terms of on the demand side, right? Yeah. You can potentially get new demand at lower or similar CAC, right? Yeah. In some ways, right? So yes, it is part of it. But a large part of it is on the supply side. Can you actually grow this? Because let's say your demand is not constrained. In overall in financial services, you demand constraint to nahi hai, right? Mm. Because honestly, if you go tell any of us also, I'll give you a loan at zero, town le denge. So the demand is not constrained. So the question is right risk, right return pick. Well, how do you actually acquire that customer, right? So which some part of it as you scale is determined by your quality of debt and you know what cost of debt is. So at some point of time, supply becomes a constraint. More so than demand, especially you know, assume your underwriting model is working, your go-to-market sales model is working, then it is a question of actually just figuring out, you know, do you have enough supply to keep growing? And at that point of time, if your supply if your supply base of money, so you're not public at that point of time, you don't have the right deposits, then you stop growing. Then what do? Then you become a small finance bank. Because if you don't become a small finance bank, you can't take deposit. So there is a path on that. The reason I'm giving all of that context is, as a founder in that position, you actually have to make this decision, right? Especially if a conglomerate like Amazon is actually giving you this offer, because you can actually, that essentially means that you can build a very large company. Because once you get that strategic on board, you don't have this problem, hopefully, of being able, to, at least one part of the problem, on infinite scaling, which is the supply side of the equation, becomes solved. That's why I think it's a very important juncture at that point of time. Say, should I raise 30, 40 million more or, you know, 50 million more? Or should I take this big strategic that is coming in? And I think that would definitely play in to any founder's mind. And I think that's why you should consider it. at this point in time, especially in the overall NBFC space and so on. Do want to say that, you know, both these founders, they were the first guys off the blocks. And they pioneered this entire space. And there is a risk and benefit to being a first mover. I think a lot of the risks on that journey did play out, right? Because, you know, they were first off the blocks when the regulatory landscape was not clear for them. So they were hit the first in a lot of these regulatory curveballs that came. And essentially the fintech industry has grown up and been formed in the last 8-10 years, and these guys have sort of been, you know, taking the brunt of some of those kind of things. I do think that there's a lot to learn from the journey, right? If you look at hindsight, when I ask all of these pioneers, right, the one mistake that they make is that they would all say that we started treating it as a tech business and not as a financial services business, which means I put too much money in tech and too much talent in tech and not as much in financial services. And this is a financial services business much more than it's a tech business. And you have to actually spend the right amount of tech at every point in time. And I love to ask you guys this, because all of you guys are building sort of tech-led, tech-enabled businesses, on how do you actually calibrate how much to spend on tech along the way. And I think all of these pioneers ended up spending more on tech than on financial services. And at the end of the day, you have only so much resources and time to spend at each stage. And I think that's one of the biggest learnings for me from the early, you know, fintech journeys, that, you know, underestimated how much it's a financial services business, which is underwriting collections and as well as sort of asset quality, and, you know, overestimated how much tech can help in reducing CAC or providing operating leverage, which even today I would argue is not played out fully. That because I keep seeing online and offline CAC in financial services in different categories. A lot of the times, offline CAC is better.
Interesting.
Vikram,
I think very pertinent points that in lending there is late mover advantage. Maybe possibly first mover advantage is a fallacy here. And also what you said, there is natural PMS. You know, paise dena to asaan hai. I think it's a business where PMF comes via collections. That's one got to figure out. I think I also wanted to touch upon, I think, this interesting point that globally we have seen standalone BNPL companies emerge, right? We have seen the success of Affirm, Afterpay. In fact, our data shows that from a consumer standpoint, you know, whenever we put BNPL options on payment page, consumers, 1/3 consumers go and click, right? So consumers want it. You know, why is there not a emergence of a standalone company in India? We have seen Zest Money also go through, you know, it had a horrible outcome. But there were talks of that also getting acquired by Flipkart. And now this has gone, at least there is a good exit to Amazon. But why in India, you know, are we still early, or are we missing something in terms of POS or checkout financing? Bajaj Finance, on the other hand, in offline has shown us that it is possible. But what are we missing? You know, many people have made an attempt. I'm sure you have had a thesis, but it hasn't played out clearly. What are we missing?
See, it's an interesting one. Our Matrix US partner, Dana Stalder, actually led this Afterpay deal early. And I have a podcast with them when, you know, they sold to Square and all of that. So I actually wanted to learn. And, you know, one of the fundamental things, especially in these markets and, you know, like after we started out in Australia and so on, one of the fundamental things is actually the convenience aspect of just that, of the BNPL at checkout, which was just not available. I think to a large part, UPI solves a lot of it, right? Just the pure convenience of you just saying, I want to adopt it immediately, right? The right person, and we'll come back to sort of who the right person is, but that right user saying at checkout, this is more convenient than actually going, reaching for my card, you know, doing something at, you know, card adoption is where it is there. All of that, there is essentially a convenience at checkout for that. That actually, for the right user, let's say somebody who has money in their bank account and is using UPI all the time, the convenience is just taken care of, right? So that's one. Then the second is, there are two parts of this BNPL. One is affordability. I was going to buy a mobile phone which costs, call it 25,000-30,000, but I want this mobile phone which costs 40,000-50,000. And, you know, because of BNPL, I can actually up. So then there is this affordability thing. And then the second is for a new brand, right? I can use a new channel or a new product. I can use a new channel saying, you know what, Chirag has a lot of users. And I can use these users to actually sell this new SKU. I'll give Chirag some margin, right? Which is called subvention in this in our world. And that's what drives the BNPL margin, right? Now, both of those, I think the affordability and picking the right person on affordability requires a lot of data, or you have to do a lot of hard work, like Bajaj does at the store, right? And now, you know, initial days, now it's not true, but initial days, Bajaj used to do a lot of hard work, right? People would come to the store and they say, mujhe EMI chahiye, right? EMI nahi milta tha. Then they'll go home. And they'll go home and actually get all the documents, and then they would buy. Now, if you want to avail your EMI, especially at the store, and Bajaj ka chahiye, toh mere ko pata hai, I need this, I need these three things. I need my PAN card, I need my salary slip, I need these things. I'll go and I'll get this loan, right? So then they created that process. So either you do a lot of that hard work, or you have the access and data. Like, for example, in this case, Axio Capital Float has, through this partnership with Amazon, to make it work, right? So that you essentially just work on that affordability spectrum. I think those partnerships are few and far between, and you will see that, you know, in a lot of cases, right, where that partnership really works, like this is a great relationship. What I understand is IDFC Axis work very closely with Flipkart on the other hand,
yeah,
on some of these things. In the bike two-wheeler universe, this has been around forever, where, you know, you essentially drive affordability through, you know, through this same BNPL financing. So as long as there is this very close partnership that you can develop, this affordability thing actually does work.
By affordability, you mean quality of underwriting, right? Is that because what you're saying is ki yaar kisko paisa dena, kisko credit dena hai, kisko nahi dena hai, uske liye jo data chahiye, wo aapko partnership se hi milega ya mehnat se milega? That's what
I think. Affordability probably means more access. I think that those are two different, like, it's questionable whether it's affordable or not, but you certainly get access to the asset.
Yeah, so I'm actually saying much more what Rivant is saying, which is that in order to actually play that affordability game, you have to know a lot about the consumer, that actually you're giving it to that person who is at that, you know, they're making this affordability trade-off and not just a, you know, great trade-off and they can't afford it. So, and therefore that needs a lot of consumer data. And that you can only either do through mehnat and doing a lot of hard work, or you have to need this close partnership.
I did want to ask you, Vikram. I think Revanth, Chirag and I have discussed this multiple times on and off the pod as founders. But just the mental model around strategic investments or strategic investors, in this case Amazon, but in general, right? I was talking to an entrepreneur in the alcohol space, and they're basically saying on day zero that they're looking at strategics very early because, of course, you know, the category doesn't lend itself to easy financing institutionally. But generally, I think when we raised from Colgate and Reckitt, there was one sense which is there's a lot of strategic value to get, but another which is it's limiting in terms of exit opportunity. They're viewed differently, but sometimes that is also a good thing because, you know, your mortality risk becomes a lot lesser, and there is kind of a quasi home separately. So, how do you as an investor, as one of the top VC investors in fintech or even otherwise, look at strategics at different stages of the company?
See,
in this case, it's played out very differently, right?
Firstly, there are strategics and there are strategics, like with everything, right? There are, you know, VC investors and then the VC investor. So there is a wide space. Now, I think in terms of, let me give you an example. I would say 15 years back, I also invest in enterprise software and SaaS, right? Maybe 20 years back, you know, Microsoft investment was, would essentially be talked about in the way you are saying that, you know, it might lead to a capped outcome. What can Microsoft offer? Right, what happens if they don't invest in the follow-on round? What happens if they don't buy? Right, don't give them strategic terms. All of that. Right? Today, right, if you get an offer from Microsoft Ventures, it's like the best thing. Right, so if you actually get get them on the cap table in the new AI world. It's very different. Right? What's changed? Right? Because they have changed the way they operate as a strategic investor. They are essentially putting in money. They are giving you access to an enormous universe. And suddenly, their brand has changed. Right? Sometimes they might buy, sometimes they might not buy. And then they have demonstrated that behavior consistently, such that even as a VC who might have all of these questions, right? I don't ask those questions anymore when they're coming in, right? Because I know that their behavior is very consistent. If the company continues to grow, they will support it. At some point of time, we might make a buy offer. Sometimes we might take it, we might not take it. They have actually made this transition. Then there are others, especially, you know, a lot of strategics are very early. They've not made a lot of investments, right? So they actually are not sure why they are doing corporate investments, right? Sometimes they think they're a corporate VC. Sometimes they think that it is to further their agenda, right? Sometimes it is to, because, arre, hame seekhna hai, right? Because, you know, we've actually, you know, they'll say all your tech founders, they're doing so many things. We want to learn some of that, right? So I would say overall, it's a very confused agenda on why they are actually investing, right? In that space, I would say it really drives clarity on saying, why are you making this investment, right? What is, because there is no consistency of behavior, right? I think, and because they are also not clear, they don't have strategic clarity on why they have started that investing program, then I think you have to ask these questions. Because, I mean, you guys are living through different things on your cap table, right? At, you know, different points in time, right? Someone on the cap table, right, that you thought like is going to be very positive at the time of entry, because, you know, you know, when you're entering, everything is positive, might actually become a irritant, or worst case, actually prevent the company from going forward. And it can happen with a strategic, right? So I would just say, you know, you need to figure out this consistency of behavior and what kind of strategic you're dealing with, and at what time of maturity for them, right? And I just give you this example of someone like Microsoft or a Salesforce who have just done this, right? Cisco in the old days used to be this, where they were just a phenomenal corporate VC and corporate M&A machine, right? So I think it's also maturity of the strategic that you're dealing with. And in this case, you know, with Amazon, I think they know what they're doing, because they just have such a gamut of partnerships, from saying, I will take a truly strategic investment where we are joined at the hip, to, hey, you're a partner, I want to help you, and, you know, I want some say in what you're doing. And then over a period of time, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, I think even if talking about the minimalist one, I think there, Unilever has a very, you know, structured format of investing through Unilever Ventures. And, you know, that's probably that bridge that led to the final consummation, or at least the consummation that has been reported in the papers of 3,000 crores.
I also wanted to quickly, I think we have discussed the Axio Amazon transaction, and it's interesting that you mentioned that because the partnership was deep, a lot of the consumer data, there was a lot of consumer data available on who to underwrite because the partnership was very strong with Amazon. Do you see that happening now with other platforms? Like, we recently had Zomato announce their results. Obviously, the markets didn't like their approach on growth versus profitability. It was very clear from the commentary and the data that they have advanced their plans to put up dark stores, and they have a lot of new dark stores which are obviously not making money, which is why the profitability of Blinkit went down, which is why the overall profitability went down, which is temporary. I mean, clearly the management is sure that if you advance your store expansion by 1 year, then you would sacrifice profits today, but you would grow a lot faster. And while this continues and the markets keep thinking as to what is going to happen in this three-way war between Zepto, Swiggy, and Zomato, Blinkit, Instamart, all of them in the mix, and I don't know, four other names that they have launched, five other apps with, on food, on everything else, do you see them adding this consumer lending layer? Because if I think about BNPL, it works great in high-frequency transactions. And there is nothing more high-frequency than food delivery, or now that we know, grocery as such. Like, it's such a beautiful use case for BNPL. why hasn't there been any partnership with these guys? Why has any consumer lending company not done it with these guys to that extent, where it's a very tight partnership? Or potentially, do we see these guys as conglomerates then eventually entering into the space as well? Though Zomato did give up its NBFC license, I think 6 months back or a year back. So it's very confusing, right? As to, it seems like a great direction to go in and tighten your grip over the consumer because you have so much underwriting data. But that's not a direction that they seem to be taking.
See, overall, and you know, I've had sort of very quick conversations with the top teams here and so on. I think everybody recognizes, right, that there is somewhere, there is a financial services profit pool, right, somewhere, right, there. And, you know, at maybe 4 or 5 years back when it was not clear, right, what the demand-led growth was, they were all trying to figure out where is the juice in the business, and, you know, financial services and fintech was actually higher up on everybody's agenda, I would say. So I absolutely think at some point of time they are going to do it, right? It was there. They tried it. It was more subscale at that point in time. You didn't have the kind of cohorts and the kind of usage they had. They have today at that point in time. So it was too early. Today, I think pulling at this thread on trying to figure out financial services partnership and so on, I think is too much of a distraction, given how big both the opportunity set as well as the competitive risk set is, right? I mean, if you see, you know, the market, and especially now two of these companies in the QCOM space are public, and the third is on its way to becoming public, right? There is so much react, and here capital is a raw material. So there is so much scrutiny, and you know, everybody looking at dissecting this, the numbers on sort of monthly transacting users with a magnifying glass, the cohorts with a magnifying glass. I think there's just so much operational complexity and strategic complexity in executing that if you now start figuring out this financial services, I think it might be a distraction. And it's not that opportunity is going away. It's always going to be there. And if anything, it's going to be larger. And because it is our user, you know, mera user hai, kahan jayega, right? I'm providing the biggest services that they want. They're living their life on me. So this opportunity is not going to go anywhere. So I think it is just a question of sequencing, and they will come to it at some point in time. The only other thing, Revant, I would say is, see, one is it's not like it's a partnership that you just switch on. That ek online plug hai and switch on kiya to ho gaya. It is actually a much deeper partnership because, for example, let's say Amazon, somebody defaulted on that. You have to go collect from that user. Amazon has to support you on collecting from that user, right? Because they're going to lose that user because you're going to go and do collections there, right? So actually it needs to work overall together much more cohesively as a business. So it's not like one of those switch it on. So it's something that requires sort of a more thoughtful investment and say this is a significant part of the business, and then you execute and then it becomes very big, right? Like if you take the ICSA-Amazon partnership, it's one of the biggest things for Amazon. Same with, you know, Flipkart Access, Flipkart IDFC and so on. So it needs the right timing at which you can actually capture that profit pool.
I think, Vikram, what you're mentioning is right, that even if we look at the Amazon, the way they have operated, you know, they have continued to build the marketplace and not ventured into the financing business on their own up till now. Right, they partnered, and they partnered like they started like 4 or 5 years ago, which was probably a decade already into the business. So you're right that currently the push is toward, or there is probably a larger market to be captured. But I do believe that the large part of this financial services value share can be captured by not doing the NBFC and maybe eventually acquiring one company the way Amazon has done, because they end up owning both in terms of underwriting data as well as the collection mechanism. Tomorrow, let's say, because what you're saying, Revant, what you were saying, that these platforms have become high frequency. You know, a Zomato, a Blinkit together can become very, very strong in terms of ensuring collection happens, because they can ensure, like, the worst case, that order will not go through unless you pay the overdue amount. So, which is a very strong position to be in. And also, what Vikram mentioned, I think this is late mover than first mover. You are better off when the depth is there, this opportunity is not going away. This is always going to compound. So, you know, you're better off if people let people build. You can always, you know, come back and bring. I think these platforms will always have right to play as well as right to win.
Let me ask a couple of different questions to you guys. One is just going back to the acquisition thread. One of the things that, you know, is part of the, I would say, fabric of the ecosystem is that if you sell your company, you're selling out. You're a sellout, right? And, you know, you're seeing some of these acquisitions happen. And I view these acquisitions as positive in the ecosystem. And, you know, I can elaborate why. But from a founder perspective, right, and you are creating these companies as your legacy. How do you think about this exit, selling out? What's the right way for founders to think about it?
I'll go first on this. I actually agree with you on the net positive thing. So think about it conversely. I actually am very excited to see that India is seeing acquisitions, and that too all cash. Even the minimalist one is rumored to be all cash. At $200, $300, $400 million, that never used to happen. We were always, you know, maybe $100 million was the max people would pay for a venture-backed company. So the fact that we are now seeing all cash offers at these prices is a very, very, very good thing. See, because we need to see success stories for the entrepreneurship cycle to keep compounding, right? Like you spoke about the 10-year compounding cycle. Everybody has to see that there are different measures of success. Somebody will create a legacy-defining company, like a hopefully the Zomato group will get to $50 billion, right? Like maybe at some point of time in 10 years get to $100 billion. And then like we look back proudly at Infosys and Reliance and said, dekho yaar, $100 billion ki company bani. There are other ways to build as well. It's not just the 40-50 year cycle of working hard, working smart, raising venture capital and getting there in 20 years is possible. And there will be outcomes like between $50 million and $500 million in cash deals where investors make some outcome. Obviously, it will not be fund returning great outcomes, but it will be good outcomes. The buyer sees strategic advantage of getting into segments, either product or distribution, that they were not there before. And most critically, we are seeing most entrepreneurs take a break for a couple of years and then do something else again, right? Also, we need different kinds of success benchmarks for everybody. Not everybody is wanting to create a 100 billion 30-year outcome. A lot of people are just doing it for passion, and they want to know that at the end of it, if they want to just retire, sell their company and do something else, those options are also available. So I think if you take the entire range of potential outcomes, it's a very good thing. There is no, in fact, if you ask me privately, I think founders are jealous when they see ki ab to relax karega yaar, ye to karke paisa leke. Like we meet a few founders who are sitting on 300, 500 crores or 1000 crores of cash after selling their company. And they're like, all I'm doing is taking a month long trip to South America and, you know, spending time with my family. And sometimes you do realize that, you know, in the end, that's also a great life. So overall, as long as the Indian entrepreneurship system gets some kind of net eventual exit outcome, whether it is good, great, fantastic, mind-blowing, that range mein kuch na kuch to hote rehna chahiye. That is most critical. So I am very happy to see that there are finally Indian strategic companies, or at least MNCs which operate in India and are serious about India, are looking at companies and acquiring them for a decent cash value. Very great for the overall entrepreneurship and innovation cycle that has to exist in this country for us to, like there was a latest report by McKinsey, right? We have 33 years to get rich before we get old. How will we get rich? We will not get rich by everybody just, you know, doing the same 9-to-5 for 5 lakh rupees in some of these service companies. We need a lot more innovation coming out of India. And as you said, make for India, make for the world, and people joining these companies and adding to that GDP. Otherwise, we are going to struggle in the next 20 years.
I have a different point of view, I think, Vikram, to your copying from your earlier statement. There are acquisitions and then there are acquisitions, right? So I think acquisitions that are accretive in the sense that you do what is best for the company and hence for its shareholders. The company goes to a better place, which has maybe a distribution or some kind of intrinsic infrastructural advantage to scale the company in ways that you and your capital cannot, right? And I think, for example, if you see the case of Minimalist, which we are discussing, I think the fact that Unilever has this massive distribution product development advantage that they can use, along with the entrepreneurial spirit of Minimalist over the last 5 years, to take a 400 odd crore company to, let's say, a 1,000-2,000 crore company, which Minimalist on its own will not be able to do. And Unilever has, I think, FMCG has typically been, M&A friendly. So you have seen, you know, kind of small brands being taken over and kind of scaled up in a big way successfully in India and outside. And I think that's a great one. I think the issue is when acquisitions happen, where there's a huge difference between the price tag and the intrinsic value of the business. And you can see that play out very quickly over the next 2, 3, 4 years, and you see what happens to that company. And many times it's very easy and lazy to say the acquirer did not pay attention to it. But, you know, we celebrated the free charge sale, and then it kind of went for 1/7 the value to Axis, and I don't know what happened to that company today. So not a great acquisition in my view. I think it lost all the value it had created and was not good. And then there are always question marks because people lose money in these situations. On the other hand, at similar time when Myntra went to Flipkart, I think Flipkart scaled it up and Mukesh was kind of able to build out Myntra within Flipkart, and then they got professional management and it became what it's become today. So my view is it's very different, and it's great for, and I agree with Revan, that it's great for founders, founding teams to make capital. I think in the Minimalist situation, it is maybe a 7/10 deal for Peak 15 or some of the investors, but like a 100/10 deal for the founders who make maybe a couple of 1,000 crores in cash, who then become LPs to Z47 and so on, right? And give you like intellect, and how do you scale a business from 0 to 5 years of that quality? And that's great for the ecosystem. But I think the proof of the pudding is what happens to Minimalist within Unilever. So the responsibility of that is with the buyer, is with the entrepreneurs, with the structuring of the deal in terms of, you know, earnouts over a period of time and so on. So I think there's no answer. For example, the Vitat situation, like 1 year of steroid driven scale, I'm sure the intrinsic value was not what it was when it was sold. And I think it was discovered very quickly over a period of time. It was kuch to galat hai isme. And then you can always say, yaar, ye to pura industry ka issue, etc. But at some point, someone's losing a ton of money by because of the delta. Yeah, that's my view on this.
Interesting. No, I think while, you know, that part is clear that we need to celebrate these outcomes, especially cash outcomes or stocks of listed companies. You know, it's a little bit of a rare thing. And we predicted, I think, in one of the pods that this is going to increase as it moves forward. We are going to see more IPOs and these companies go out and acquire. But I think from a founder perspective, it's always a battle between logic and emotion here. That, you know, as a founder, you will have a vision. You are mentally set that, you know, you want to build it out. You want to change the world. So there is this emotional aspect to it that you have, you know, put so much effort to get to a PMF, get to some scale. And then, you know, there is this opportunity which, you know, and we have seen how M&As work out, right? On the other side, you know, all logic will make it very tempting. You know, one is the amount of money coming in. Two is, let's say, you know, people trying to create this equation on an Excel that there is synergy, right? So logic will say, and also we are seeing that, you know, there is larger efficiency at scale. So logic will always say that, you know, okay, this makes sense. This works out. But the founder emotion in terms of how you've built out is a different one to solve for. You know, how do you solve for that? And how do you keep it aside? And I think in Indian ecosystem, I would want to separate that emotion from one is the largeness of, or why did you start? And is there, can you push the envelope in terms of mission by merging or by getting acquired? But I think the second one, which at least, you know, one should stay away, or Indians need to keep it away, is that founder ego beech mein nahi aana chahiye ki if it's outcome, you know, for everyone else and you also, then getting a founder ego, I've seen this, ki main Indian founder ko to nahi bechunga. You know, I will sell it to a Microsoft, I will sell it to a global CPG company, but Indian founder ko nahi bechunga. Right? So, one needs to separate that.
The ego is also a very interesting thing, right? Because many times acquisitions don't happen because people, like founders typically, especially those who have kind of taken many years to build it, their identity becomes their company. So then, while it might be great for the company, while it might be great for the shareholders, while it might be great for them also, but they're like, boss, you're basically like, who am I?
Karunga kya
main? Am I? What? No, forget about karna kya main. Main hu kaun? Agar maine Bombay Sharing Company bech diya, to main kaun hu? So I think that is a risk, for, by the way, for the company and the shareholders. This is an identity issue. And we've seen, especially in consumer, like a lot of companies don't do it because they just like, the founders don't know what to do with their time. Another issue, I think, Vikram, to your question is, a bad Apple acquisition leads to very bad faith. Yeah. Like we, after the Ranbaxy situation, it took ages for Japanese investors to kind of build faith in India as a country, right? For a long time. It was like, and I think that was a very extreme example, but I think there's a huge responsibility on the seller, on the lawyers, on, you know, the current board, etc., to make sure that it is done in good faith. So that, you know, this is just, it kind of creates, the synergy is kind of promised, as probably, of course, things will go here and there and all of that is fine. But people should not look back and say, I'm never touching an asset like that again. Because that is reputationally problematic for everyone in the ecosystem.
You know, I don't envy you guys because these decisions come fast and furious. And if somebody was to tell me, you know, you have to sell Z4Dspend tomorrow and tell us that, we would say, who are you to tell us all this stuff? And I have the same emotional attachment question. But I will pick out two things that you guys said, right? One is, you know, what Rehan said on, you know, having different kinds of role models in the founder ecosystem and these outcomes in the founder ecosystem, I think is just very important just for that innovation cycle to keep going. And Shantanu, to your point, you know, and both you and Chirag said this, that, you know, if the mission is continuing in a different way, right, which is you created this company to solve a particular problem and essentially solve it to the fullest at scale, and if that mission is being fulfilled, and I think that's one way in which I would say founders end up getting over the line. Is that mission is being fulfilled for founders. And I think that's where I have seen a click for founders. That it might not, you know, this is not the vehicle to fulfill the mission, but the mission is actually being fulfilled. And then actually that flippant mental model actually then gets over the line. Finally, I will say is, you know, from a LP and investor perspective, these sort of base hits in terms of just outcomes that are happening are very good, even from an investor model, right? Especially with cash, with swaps and so on. This is actually, you know, if you take the global VC model and early investor model, these acquisitions, which keep coming, you know, at a decent velocity, are actually very important for the VC investor model. So even though, you know, you might not be tom-tomming these, like a lot saying, okay, this is like this huge IPO, and so you're posting pictures on LinkedIn, but actually it's very important and fundamental to the VC model.
Absolutely.
One perspective, because you put that point out there, Vikram, is I guide some senior founders now. I think once you are out of your PMF and focused on scaling, I think it's important to segregate the founder from the shareholder from the employee. Like Chirag is founder, but he's also a shareholder and he's also an employee while playing the role of CEO. So thinking of yourself as a shareholder and an employee becomes easier to then make these decisions objectively, because the founder role is just an emotional role. And 8 to 10 years into the company, you have to think more as a shareholder because you're custodian for all the shareholders, right? Or as a CEO, you are the custodian for shareholder value for all shareholders, not just yourself. So as soon as you dilute and have multiple shareholders, or if you have an ESOP pool and you have employees who are also shareholders, taking care of all shareholders is the responsibility of the CEO. So I think tomorrow, maybe, you know, a large blue chip or Microsoft wants to come and say, I'll buy Z47 and, you know, let's make it a corporate arm. As long as you're thinking as for all shareholders, you'll come to the right decision. The ego only comes in because of that emotional aspect of being the founder. But it's, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years into building a company. Because like I have people with me who have been with me from day one. They are as much founders of this company as I am. So it's easier to then think of yourself as a shareholder, as an employee who's primary fiduciary responsibilities to all shareholders. And then the decision making just becomes very, very objective in that sense. I know it sounds a little cold-hearted because missionary founders by design have to stay true to the mission, but you can't, I think what happens is as a company scales, sometimes you start selling that missionary story so much to yourself, you start lying to yourself sometimes. But anyway, I think that's a topic for another. We should not end up making this a philosophical discussion. Our audience comes for the data insights and Chirag's charts and people's insights on it, and not on philosophical discussions on what founders should do.
I think philosophical discussion is what is the crowd puller, Revath. You might see increased views because of the philosophical angle that Vikram has added to this discussion.
No, amazing. I think we've touched a little bit on the Zomato results, but maybe we can cover more on food delivery and Quickcom once the Swiggy results are also out. But
yes.
I mean, any broad thoughts, Vikram, on the growth versus profitability framework that they seem to have chosen? Markets don't seem to like it, but clearly they are seeing a lot more leading indicators on why this could be the right decision compared to what they have been doing in the last couple of years.
See, for me, what stood out is the cohort, right? Which is, you know, if you see the two-year cohort getting to 42%, and I think the GMV retention is right below that, right? Which is this, 144%. Essentially, the 42% is spending that 144%, right? So, you know, it's essentially that the people who remain are actually spending 3x, or actually 3.4x. What they were spending, right? So it's the biggest indicator of the kind of consumer value, right, that that business is adding. Then you are seeing the competitive forces come through, right, where, you know, you're seeing Swiggy come at you, you're seeing Zepto come at you, and you have unbelievable category leadership lead. You're, as Zomato, you have food delivery category leadership lead. And now I think on Qcom, they're at 10 million plus transacting users, and that's probably double what everyone else has. Right? So if you say, I'm seeing these cohorts, which are saying that consumers love it, and I'm seeing category leadership potential in what is probably the biggest e-com play that this country has seen because it just happened in such a short period of time, then as a founder, not pressing the pedal is not an option in my view. So that you actually have to go for it. And so it is absolutely the right decision speaking as an early stage investor, who's saying, okay, there is humongous category leadership potential to create this 50 billion company and 100 billion company. I would say those are just the absolute right decisions to be making in that period of time, especially as food delivery also is seeing some tapering.
But on the food delivery part, we, you know, I think 4 or 5 episodes back when we were covering this, when we had the Swiggy results, we were doing an analysis. We discussed that actually Swiggy got a 0.1% share back in food delivery just the previous quarter itself. And it seemed that Swiggy Bolt, the 10-minute or 15-minute food delivery initiative, seemed to be working for them. There is commentary that we'll wait for the Swiggy results to come out, but there is a hypothesis that they are losing market share in food because there is excitement around the 10-minute food delivery, which they were a little early on that they shut it, and now they seem to be a little late on it because that seems to be hurting them a little on the food delivery side. Any thoughts on that?
Honestly, I haven't seen the data on it, and you know, this 10-30 basis point shift at least is not enough to convince me that this is going to be a significant change, right? Because see, the question is from a I have a few friends who are public market investors. They are actually seeing two things. One is, what is the market construct of an existing market that they know sort of well, and they have patterns, right? Which is the food delivery market. There is a market construct that they have established in their mental model. Overall market growth will be so much. Zomato I've forgot now, 55-60% market share. Maybe 2/3 in certain quarters, Swiggy is there, and they're adjusting that market construct. Is that enough to change that market construct? I'm not sure, right? And you know, I might well eat my words in a quarter saying that this 10-minute delivery is going to surprise me as much as Qcom has, right? And I'm not sure it will, but I think that's the question, right? Does the market construct significantly change? I don't think it does as much. Now,
Vikram, just to add in between here, I think in the earnings call also Zomato said that while display is emerging, it is not going to change a lot of market dynamics or market share movement at the moment, it looks like. Dipinder has made a statement that demand does get accelerated, does increase because of 10-minute food delivery. But it's still very, very early days. It shouldn't be a market share movement tactic now.
I think we'll, in a week or 10 days, we'll have the Swiggy results. I think we'll be surprised with, I have a hypothesis that Swiggy will gain even in a quarter. And it may just be 0.1 or 0.2, but I think if you believe in compounding, it will take only 4 quarters. See, this is exactly what Zomato did to Swiggy, right? It creeps on you very fast if you seed market share and these things. But let's see. I think we should have a more detailed conversation around this once we have the Swiggy results as well. Then we can actually do the like to like. But good to hear that even at this scale, $20+ billion market cap, while the public market shareholders seem to have panicked and not rewarded their growth over profitability framework. Maybe there are other concerns around eventual long-term profit pool if this battle is going to continue to last, right? Because if with Flipkart Minutes coming in, Amazon now just starting Tez, we don't know till when this growth versus profitability is going to be is this going to be a permanent trade-off is maybe where the worry is.
Yeah, and I think, Vikram, don't you look at it that way that, you know, when an industry or a player is growing 100% plus year on year, then, you know, at least the writing is on the wall that other people are going to come in and go for that market share. So I think it was quite like writing on the wall, wherein the movement had to change. We had said it, that this is going to lead to consumer delight. You know, I have seen Blinkit do a delivery fee now. So there is no delivery fee now. So it's clearly market share, which is, you know, at least in a high growth industry where there is high size of price, huge size of price. That's the only way to play the game. And maybe they were pushed by Zepto, which said that they are going to open 1250 dark stores by March 2025. Right. So they have, in the private market space, they have been like just on rampage in terms of execution. They couldn't just afford to lose this. What my sense is, what it means for the market is that I think both the stocks have already taken a beating, because, you know, all the discounted cash flow models would indicate that profit is now much, much ahead. But the game is on for, taking up more market share.
Yeah, just on that, right? You know, when we see this go, volatility and basis these decisions, right? I think we've just unpacked that this decision might be the right decision for the company, just in terms of sort of both consumer delight as well as competition. And one thing we didn't unpack is that the AOV has also crossed 700 there, right? So everything on the consumer metric seems like this is the right, you have to press the accelerator. But from when you look at it from a market perspective, there are two things happening. One is you want certainty of performance to be underwritten. And it's falling off that certainty of performance, right? So that's one thing that is happening. And second is, you said there were some risks, and those risks are playing out. That competitive risk is essentially going to reduce the profit pool in the short term for everyone. So uncertainty is happening, and risks are playing out. So obviously, you say that your expected NPV is going down, so your stock is going down. So. But I, that doesn't mean it's the wrong strategy, right? It doesn't mean it's the wrong strategy. But from an underwriting of the stock perspective, uncertainty aa gaya, risk badh gaya, so obviously it will go down.
Mere hisab se to Vikram aur koi option hi nahi hai, yahi karna hai. And you would have seen this play out in a lot of your private companies, you know, wherein they will start to gain market share, and then you would say, okay, you know, let's go out and grab more market share. But I think it will be interesting for viewers. I think, Devant and Shantanu, you also run consumer companies, and Vikram, of course, you look at consumer companies, that why is this cohort, let's say for viewers, why is this cohort state of art? You know, just unpack it for the viewers.
I have never seen such cohorts in my business. So for me, it's state of art only from that perspective. I think only a platform can have these cohorts, right? I don't think a product business can have these cohorts. I have at least not seen even the best in class product business not. Because anyway, you don't own the distribution most of the time. So it's very hard to measure as well. But from a platform business, whether it's, and this largely also happens in monopolistic or duopoly kind of markets, right? Whether it's mobility where Ola, Uber, Vikram can maybe give some perspective on seeing similar cohorts as an investor in Ola.
So why are these cohorts so impressive? And, you know, fundamentally, let's say the business stopped acquiring customers today, right? Theoretically, right? Stop acquiring customers today. What this is saying is that the same customers will keep driving more and more of your business, which actually is a great path to profitability. Because you're not acquiring users, you're going to serve the same people. That is why when you see such an expansion cohort where the same users are giving you more and more of their money and time and essentially giving more of their life on you, it's a phenomenal thing, right? Now, within that, when you look at these kind of benchmarks, right, you see them maybe in SaaS companies, right? Where you do a lot of upfront work and then that company itself is growing very fast and their usage is growing very fast, then you see some of this, right? Like a company like, or, you know, payments companies like Axi Chirag, you might see some of these cohorts because, you know, the companies explored on that. And you see the goodness that comes through. We've seen it both with you guys at WorkQuick, at RazorPay. This happens, right? Because the same customer, that customer is doing so well in their life that goodness is coming to you. That's what is happening here. That is why this is just so, so important that you acquire a set of users, 100 users, then I mean, essentially this is saying 100 users, 40 are remaining, but the 40 are actually spending 1.5 times what they were spending, right? Then if you keep acquiring more and more of those users, then this is essentially going to be the right way to build your company.
Yeah. Oh, I think net DK hai nahi, right? The way you are explaining that there is no incrementality hai. So you have to put it right way ki main nahi customers nahi bhi acquire karu. I think it just continues to hold on to them. There is very strong PMF in the offering.
I'm surprised by the 42% retention, by the way. I would have assumed it will be a lot higher.
Yeah, but Shantanu, I think wo drop ho jata hai first quarter mein. You look at the 100 to 48 and then it stays there.
These are trial consumers who never come back. Does the industry lose them or what happens? They leave the country?
Good. You know, investors
Dubai nahi hai yaar ki log immigration population kya kar rahe ho
khana to chahiye na tumko tum mahine mein ek bar to order karoge na kahan like where are you like are you going to
nahi but I think yaar imagine you're a household that has 10,000 15,000 rupee monthly income once in a while you just try something but you can't afford to do that so our pen like
maybe,
look at the number of app downloads
household retention dekhenge na to aur acha hai
shayad.
Yeah. See, no, but Chantra, think about this. Zomato has 200 million plus downloads. Yeah. So, like, even sometimes a cab driver who's earning 30,000 would have downloaded and maybe ordered once. And then once every 4 months, it's an indulgence for him to do that. But,
classically bola nahi jata in a consumer business that, let's say, you, jaise Facebook mein bola jata na, if you get like 10 friends, then you are hooked. I think either be some of that is being demonstrated that let's say you order three, four orders. Mm-hmm. I think then you're hooked.
Yeah.
So Vikram, one interesting development which has happened and you watch the payments industry, you've been seeing that for a while now, which is that, you know, JustPay, which has become a large company orchestrating PMEGs. And, you know, they function with some of these large companies, Swiggy, First Cries of the world. And then they work with, you know, they have been an orchestrator. They enable all the different payment gateways and primarily serve the merchant in terms of selecting which, you know, a PAPG they want to work with and ensuring that they don't have to do integrations again and again is the value prop. And they have, of course, gone very deeper into the stack. I think what news is emerging today is that PhonePe, of course, decided to part ways with or not participate in that orchestration layer with JustPay. We are hearing that even CashFree as well as RazorPay have decided that in 3 months' time, they are like they've given notices to their merchants that they're not going to support or they're going to move away from that orchestration there. Now, how do you look at this, you know, as a development from a payments ecosystem? You know, it's a little bit of a war that who has more value to add. You know, I would believe orchestrators can't function without, you know, these PAPGs. But having said that, JustPay has got a PAPG license. So does that. And my sense is that I think it got triggered because of it. You know, once they got the license, and I think it was quite imperative that they are going to bring their own PAPG and then, you know, make others even more redundant. So, you know, while, you know, if you run a PAPG business, your share of wallet is always the metric which you keep asking, which in this case became in the hands of JustPay. But how do you look at this overall development from an ecosystem point of view?
Yeah, so I'll get the disclaimers out first. One, you know, we were the first investors in RazorPay. We continue to be, you know, large shareholders there. We're also investors in Chirag's company, GoQuick. So I'll get all the disclaimers out of the way on that. And I don't have, you know, very different information. But I do have a perspective, which is, see, overall, JustPay built this business on what you said, which is the orchestration layer, right? Which is, you know, for a e-com platform, I don't have to do the multiple integrations and I'll figure out, you know, how to get your business overnight run on so many PGs and so on. And that's what the company essentially built their business on. And, you know, obviously they had a large role to play in the UPI ecosystem and so on. Chirag, what you said, right, which is they have ambitions and aspirations of being a PAPG. They stated those aspirations. They put that out. Now, this doesn't happen overnight, right? Imagine like what has happened behind the scenes. There's lots of conversations that have happened. There is a implicit partnership, right? Because you're essentially moving from a company which is enabling the payment ecosystem to saying, now I will provide direct services to merchants, right? Which is what your partners are doing, right? And your partners are, you know, the RazorPays, CashFrees, you know, PayU's and so on for the world. And your value is in orchestrating those partners. Now, once you stated this ambition that I'm going to replace that and go direct to the merchant, and then the partnership behavior over the last 12, 24 months has also indicated that that's where you want to go. I think this was an eventuality that these guys will go off the platform. So I was saying it was an eventuality that, you know, the payment gateway would go off the platform and then they would break that partnership because you are essentially pushing the partnership away in some way. So I would be very surprised if JustPay had it planned on this happening, right? Because this is an eventuality of the strategy that you have pursued. So it's not that, you know, it suddenly happened overnight. It's an eventuality. So I think they have done it with the knowing fully well that this is where it would end up. Now, you know, what was the exact trigger and so on? Is hard to actually say that this is exactly the trigger. But it's been building up over a period of time, right? So it's not like something that's happened overnight. Now, I think this is maybe the second part of the question that you asked is, you know, how do you view it from an ecosystem perspective and so on, right? I don't know if it actually affects the ecosystem as a whole, right? But I think it's important to actually say, especially in the fintech and, you know, banking space and overall, there is a supply chain that exists, right? And it is actually also a regulated supply chain where different companies are different regulatory actors in that space. And therefore, they have a space, right? They have a PAPG, right? There's somebody who's doing just switch and so on, right? So I think one is that there is a supply chain framework in which I think, A, there is tremendous depth in just doing and providing that service because, you know, again, that's another game that is just beginning. So if you just have crazy scale, just in, let's say, credit cards, the credit card stack, right? As credit cards explode, there is a large company to be built there. And any kind of break in these partnerships where you intrude into your partner's turf in some way, either, you know, with regulatory cover or without, actually you're going to break your compounding in that journey. So you have to do it because your sliver is not too large, and therefore you are willing to break that partnership and willing to go down a different path, right? But otherwise, if you take the overall fintech ecosystem, the different actors have different roles, and each of those roles has become humongous. Take an RTA like CAM in the wealth space, right? CAM is an RTA just through this entire wealth explosion journey 2018 onwards has become humongous. And you know, maybe I'm forgetting the overall market cap on CAMs. It's one of the like biggest stories, and they do a very simple thing, and they stay doing that in mutual funds, right? Which is they're just an RTA, and they keep doing that. And obviously, just the scale has been humongous. So I think it's important to understand, maybe for founders in the fintech space, because there's always, you know, some level of greed that, you know, I'm a picks and shovels business. Why don't I become a lender? Why don't I start doing this? Why don't I start doing that? But I would advise those founders that, you know, doing what you're doing, and especially if you captured the kind of market share Juspay had in that one business, you can scale that one business. I don't know Juspay enough as a business. We've never looked at it to say that, you know, what the profit pool was there versus in PAPJ and so on. Chirag, how do you look at it?
No, it's a very sliver business, sliver of sliver, I would say. You know, we know that it's at best a 5 bps business. But it's a software business, you know, wherein you are enabling. So it's a like high gross margin business. I think, you know, from an ecosystem point of view, I think the answer will come in 3-6 months that who adds most value. You know, if I speak to merchant would say that, you know, I need Juspay because I think it enables them to, you know, get all PGs to fight with each other. And it will also prove that, you know, are these all PAPGs like commoditized today? Or I know for sure that they have value additions in different buckets, like you mentioned in credit card, somebody's very deep in debit, somebody's very deep in international. So that's why, you know, as a merchant, you would end up using multiple. From an ecosystem point of view, I think if these two large players go out, I think it definitely means opportunity for, let's say, a PayU or anyone who's emerging to offer their services deeply with Juspay, and can they scale? Of course, it means that, you know, Juspay, PAPG can also scale. So, you know, and you are right ki ye baat sahi hai ki, you know, you start the business with saying, hum bhai bhai hain, you know, dono roti ka half of karke khayenge. And then suddenly one day comes and then you say, ki nahi, ab ye roti puri mein khaunga. And by the way, what you said is also true, that when Juspay would have started, it was still a very small business. But I think the way they have executed, they have built a fantastic tech stack. The revenue pool is quite sizable. Yeah. It's not that, you know, it's a very, very small, and they had to do this. I think maybe, you know, SoftBank coming in is probably the preemptive move.
Yeah. And there are very smart people on the Juspay side. That's why I'm saying, you know, if they had not predicted this as an eventuality, I would be very surprised. And so it might have come faster than they thought, which is how usually risks play out. But if they haven't planned for it, I would be very surprised.
But trigger to Vikram usi se hua hai, because I know for sure that Razorpay and Cashfree both had their optimizer orchestration layers, right? And when you are a party in conflict, you know, people won't use you. So there is always a need for a neutral orchestration layer, right? Now that neutrality is gone. So, you know, actually, it's an interesting one. Does it mean that there is a space for second Juspay now?
I definitely think there is, because there is a need, especially for the smaller merchants. I think in all of this, if you ask me who loses, is the smaller merchants who have less engineering bandwidth and less sophistication, and therefore they lose, right? For any of the larger merchants, right, they are essentially going to borrow one of somebody's stack, including what you just said, and run a neutral operation for themselves. They will actually be okay, right? And they have enough direct integrations and so on, and they will be okay. And for the larger merchants, the large PAPGs will actually put engineering bandwidth to actually figure something out for them. It's the smaller merchants who are going to suffer, and therefore I'd love to see what happens to smaller merchants, you know, as these go off the platform, and what happens to sort of conversion rates and failure rates.
Yeah.
What else, Vikram? What else is top of mind? Chirag, Revan, what else top of mind for you guys before we close?
My worry is my low recovery yesterday. So, मेरी तो फटी पड़ी है कि भाई ये
भाई HRV कितना important रहता है ये बताओ.
Yeah, yeah. I have just taken off my Whoop because but I will tell you the secret to actually wearing this Whoop is I realized that when I wake up in the morning, I don't look at it. I will go work out and discover how I'm feeling, and I'll work out fully, and then I will look at all this because otherwise, you become depressed.
Same data has started to overrule and say ki subah utke dekhiye ab recovery kharab hai, ab din kharab hi jane wala.
Yeah, exactly, man. I don't want to look at.
Hey, but it's like quite a thing, yaar. You are right. Ki it's been 6 months for me, or ye ho gaya abhi ki subah utte hi first thing instead of WhatsApp you checked. Okay, how was the sleep? And then that
did you take
that
magnesium?
Kind of decides.
Shantanu,
sorry.
Did you take the magnesium gummy?
Yeah, I did. So the okay. So now we let it this out. The 3 days I took the gummy, I did not sleep well. The day I didn't take it was yesterday. I slept really well. So my GABA drink and your magnesium gummies are totally in conflict. But let me add this. I think the 3 days I took the gummies, I did not work out. So, and yesterday
you
I worked
to,
out.
Workout is a very big, you have to so I think tire your body.
Yeah, the workout impact on the sleep was very clear.
No, if but you, today if you I'm have all things constant, if you have all things constant, so for example, last entire week, I didn't take it for a week, janbujhke. And this week I have started taking. What gets impacted is your deep sleep and your REM sleep.
Yeah.
The magnesium impact is not ki overall neend zyada aayegi, but your deep sleep and REM sleep as a percentage of overall sleep increases.
What should it be? REM and deep upon total?
Close to 50%.
Together.
Yeah. Together. Okay. Together. Ryan Johnson gave his data for yesterday. It's fucking 70%. Like, it's crazy. How he gets 70% of his sleep is deep and REM. It's just mind-blowing.
Let's chase the right matrices. Shantanu, in this case, sleep is one of those things ki if you start chasing it, na, fir wo nahi aati hai. So you don't get a key to magnesium where you are saying ki 3 days you had it and it means that you were like consciously thinking ki aaj badhiya neend aane wali
hai. kuch to hoga bhai wo then, mushroom nahi hai ki feel nahi aa raha hai karke yaar sab kuch I am not seeing clouds or something aisa kuch nahi hone wala
hai. I completely agree with Chirag. Maine ye sab experiment kiya apne upe and I actually swear by the magnesium gummy, but I would say I did all these experiments, kuch nahi hua. Ek din maine bahut fight mari. Main workout bhi kiya, bahut kaam kiya, but and at the end of it, I slept without thinking. It was the best sleep I got.
it's like Schrodinger's cat, right? I think the observation changes outcome. I think it's important. I think it's very important. But I want to ask you guys, you three are all super health freaks. HRV ka kya scene? Heart rate variability.
I am a big believer in HRV, but I think Garmin has conditioned me to be a big believer in HRV. But it does, I can see that, on the days that, my HRV trend, because it's hardly, I don't know if you know what HRV is. HRV is essentially your subconscious system fighting with your active system and telling you to calm down and rest. So as long as you two are in balance, your the variability between heart rate should be high, right? So I actually think that at least that with a correlation with how I'm feeling is actually quite high.
Yeah, my last
and
2 weeks.
And Chandru, you can't compare people to people. So, for example, you can't compare it with me or Vikram. I think what you have to see is you have to see a trend line.
Yeah,
that
so my
it has
HRV
to go
over last 1 week. Ever since I had stopped working out a week back, HRV is I travel and wasn't well, so HRV came down. And now, a 1 day of workout, it immediately spiked back upwards. So now I want to see now how this moves basis different things. And everyone is right, you kind of keep everything else constant and change one variable. Brian Johnson is going to learn a little bit about himself, which is like 1/10 or 1/100 the experimentation possibility that is allowed to Mr. Johnson.
Waiting for the day, some young guy comes and puts the comment on this ki yaar char budhao log itna soch rahe hai, boss get a girlfriend or something like that.
Are budhao hai isliye sochna padta hai.
But do you know this, Revan, that you should why are 40 year olds looking 25 and 25 year olds looking 40? What's happening there? मुझे लगता है यार Gen Z like all these 25 27 year old kids look old dude.
मतलब मैं 25 हूँ, do I look like 40?
I'm young. Three of you look the same since I first met you.
You didn't see the comment on the last episode that Revan, nobody is Shantanu and Chirag are not taking your hair gummies. And see, everyone knew you were bald, but Chirag offense le liya ki itne mere baal kam ho gaye karke. So people are was noticing. Please don't comment. Like agle comment mein kuch to aayega ki ye aapke yahan pe चार बार और बाल कम हो गए आपके या इतने बाल सफेद हो रहे हैं. लाइक आई डोंट नो प्रॉब्लम विद दिस 4K कैमरा सब कुछ दिख जाता है. एक तो एवरी माइन्यूट फ्लॉ इज आल्सो सीन. विक्रम आई डू थिंक जेन इज लुकिंग अ लॉट ओल्डर.
या बट आई डिडंट यू लुक अ लॉट ओल्डर एट दैट. आई सी सम ऑफ माय पिक्चर्स फ्रॉम दैट टाइम 25 to 30. आई लुक हॉरिबल. And I'm like, and I asked my wife, "Kyun shaadi ki tune ye sab dekh ke?" But you know, you just take all of this for granted because your body's still moving, and it's like it doesn't matter. You drink a lot, and then the next morning you play basketball. It's still moving, it's still happening. So you just take it for granted. Aise hi chalti hai. Then I think
maybe you look older in your 20s and younger in your 30s, or you start looking younger the moment you become conscious. I think that may be the thing. You're right.
So
I awesome. Think you're but just yeah. getting a little excited, Shantanu, with your own looks. Kuch hum young nahi dikh rahe hain.
No, no.
Please.
And zero assumption on this. By the way, the world has humbled me enough on the looks part of it since my pre-pubescent days, when I had a full head of hair also. But yeah, I think this has been a fantastic episode, yaar. Vikram, thank you so much for the time, man. Like, really appreciate it.
Boss, I really enjoyed it, and you know, honestly, I didn't expect to enjoy myself so much, and you know, but I will say, बहुत homework देते हो तुम लोग, तो which also I enjoyed actually finally.
हम लोगों ने हमारे अलग ग्रुप पे लिखा है कि ये जो senior partner है ना VC fund के, इनको homework बहुत सालों बाद मिला है किसी से. So they are having to deal with it.
अरे सारा homework मैंने नहीं किया. I want to shout out to my 12 young investors, Taha and Kishan, jinne homework karke phir
kar diya. I knew it. It would have been funneled as a delegation to someone else. Quickly. And today 9:15 after your LP meeting, you would have said, I have a 15-minute call with these guys. Quickly give me a too long didn't read version of it. So that... Hey, but yeah, it was very good to get your perspectives, and you know, like, you're such an active investor personally and you know, institutionally, that it's always good for us and for viewers to kind of know how you're thinking, you know, what you're looking at, what excites you, and so on. I think it's perspective that we honestly like will not have individually or even together. So thank you so much for you and the team for taking the time.